From WBUR in Boston, I'm Karen Given, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Bill Littlefield is away this week. Ahead on Only a Game, the Olympic torch relay protests and what may lay ahead on the path to the Beijing Summer Games. Also, the Tigers insist they will dwell only briefly at the bottom of the AL Central, and the story of two brothers, two sneaker brands, and the fight for the soul of a family. Also ahead, taking a chance on a new sports museum near Ground Zero.
As someone who was working and standing 25 blocks away watching what happened, the impact for me was, you know, if you really believe in something, you just need to do it.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. Bill Littlefield is chasing the FIFA World Cup torch relay through the streets of Guatemala and Papua New Guinea and Antarctica. The National Hockey League playoffs began on Wednesday. Joining me now on the line to analyze the prospects of Sharks, Bruins, Predators, and other predators, as well as icy prey like the Penguins and Ducks, is Helene Elliott of the LA Times. Hi, Helene.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thank you. The Montreal Canadiens are the top seed in the East and have won the first game in their opening round series with the Boston Bruins. The Habs look like they have their best chance to win Lord Stanley's Cup since the 1993 title team. How far can they go?
I think this is great. I think this is one of the best things that has happened to the NHL. It's like in the old days when people in Montreal expected the Cup every year. This is it's been a terrific season for them. They have a terrific young goaltender in Carey Price. The city is apparently going nuts over him and over the team. And it's the way it used to be, you know, when Montreal was a power in the league. And it'll be interesting to see how this young goalie handles the pressure. You know, the first round you're playing on adrenaline and, you know, everybody's your friend and everybody loves you. But let's see what happens once the pressure ratchets up a notch or two and whether he's still everybody's darling a week or two from now.
The Washington Capitals, the Southeast Division champions, are in the playoffs for the first time since 2003. Caps left winger Alexander Ovechkin scored 65 goals this season and, barring mass insanity by the voters, will be the league MVP. Can Ovechkin single-handedly lead Washington to the title?
That would be pretty difficult. He's a terrific player, though. I mean, this is exactly what the NHL was hoping to see. I mean, Gary Bettman, the commissioner in the league office, they're all just jumping up and down with joy because they have Ovechkin in the playoffs and Sidney Crosby in the playoffs, and it's the young players, and they're just so happy. It's disgusting, but I think that it's a little bit too much to ask Ovechkin to carry them to the finals. I know I've seen some people pick the Capitals to go to the finals, and I was looking at it and going, whatever they were smoking, I would like some of that. The Caps are a good story, and their coach, Bruce Boudreau, is a wonderful story. He had been a coach in the Kings minor league system for many years, never got a chance in the NHL to coach, and here he is kind of out of desperation. They give this guy the job and he just brings the team together. It's a great thing to see. This is a terrific guy who deserved that chance for a long time, and I'm delighted to see that the Capitals are doing as well as they are.
The New Jersey Devils and the New York Rangers first-round series features two offenses that are among the league's worst. Insomniacs might enjoy a seven-game series, but will anyone else?
Only if you're related to people on the Devils and then the rest of the Sutter family, I think. It's just the Devils are just deadly boring, and I know that's maybe a little bit of a cliche, but that's how they play. That's how they've played for the last decade, and it's just terrible to watch at times. I mean, I watched the first game, and there were far more Ranger fans in the building in New Jersey than there were Devil fans. I mean, I don't think they would have sold the place out if not for the Ranger fans going across the river to New Jersey. I understand defense wins championships in any sport, and that's absolutely true. But you do need to score a few goals, and I'm not sure that the Devils will do that.
In the West, the Detroit Red Wings have the top seed, and their first-round pairing with the Nashville Predators looks like a mismatch. But the Wings were the top seed 2 years ago as well and lost in the first round to the Edmonton Oilers. Any chance of history repeating itself this year?
No, I mean, I think the games will be close, and the Nashville Predators coach, Barry Trotz, deserves so much credit because that team was just basically stripped for payroll considerations. The team was going to be sold, and they got rid of all their high-priced players, and the fact that they even made the playoffs is just a testament to how good a coach this guy is and how much the players respect him. But they just don't have the depth that the Red Wings have. They just don't have the high scorers that the Red Wings have. They don't have the terrific defense that the Red Wings do, and it'll be a respectable loss. It'll all be like 3-1 with an empty net goal and that kind of thing. But I really feel bad for the Predators. They had the odds against them all season, and they get this far, and now it's going to be a quick dismissal for them.
As usual, the San Jose Sharks are one of the most talented teams in the league, but this year's number 2 seed in the West has a history of underachieving in the postseason. Do the Sharks finally figure out how to make the Stanley Cup Finals?
Underachieving is the polite way to put it. Most people would say choking. You know, it's difficult to pick the Sharks to win anything. I'm sorry. They just have not shown the guts to close out a series when they had the chance. You could just look year after year after year when they had a chance to put an opponent away, and they didn't. And until they actually do it, I'm just not picking them to win anything. Sorry. I know they're the trendy pick this year, but sorry, I ain't picking them.
Well, the Anaheim Ducks, the defending Stanley Cup champions, were one of the hottest teams in the league the last half of the season. While their first-round opponent, the Dallas Stars, had stumbled at the end of the regular season, but Dallas had an easy 4-0 win in Game 1, so will the Ducks come up lame in Round 1?
Yeah, they certainly looked lame in that opener. My goodness, all the things that they said but they can't do, they did. We can't take dumb penalties. They took dumb penalties. We can't let our penalty killing struggle. Their penalty killing was bad. We can't let our goaltender be there alone. We have to, you know, give him some help. They left poor Jean-Sébastien Jagr alone, and they abandoned him and gave him very little help throughout the whole game. This is a team that wasn't sure what its identity was. You know, they had a big turnover in personnel since last season. They had become more reliant on their defense, and they just had no offense at all. In the first game, there was just no offense there at all. I wonder if that was enough of a wake-up call for them, or if it's going to be, well, you know what? We had a long season last year and a short summer. We just don't have the legs. I think the second and third games of this series are really going to be big in terms of defining who they are and how badly they want to win the cup again.
Helene Elliott covers the NHL for the Los Angeles Times. Helene, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Their 2-8 record notwithstanding, the Detroit Tigers are still expected to challenge the Cleveland Indians for the AL Central crown. Despite their weak early season, many feel they're poised for a long playoff run, thanks to baseball's biggest offseason trade by the architect who has built one of the American League's strongest lineups. Only a Game's Ron Schachter reports.
Detroit's lineup is the kind you might expect from the New York Yankees. The Yankees of the 1920s and 30s. John Morosi covers the Tigers for the Detroit Free Press.
7 All-Stars in the everyday lineup, not including Curtis Granderson, who could have easily been an All-Star last season. You'll have Pudge Rodriguez, a Hall of Famer, batting 8th, which is a pretty strong statement of how good the offense is going to be. So it's very, very rare in baseball in this day and age to see an offense with this much depth.
Those All-Stars include Maglio Ordóñez, who won the AL batting title with a .363 average and knocked in 139 runs last year. Gary Sheffield, who contributed 25 of his nearly 500 career home runs, and recently arrived Miguel Cabrera, who averaged better than 30 homers and 115 RBIs a season for the Florida Marlins. All the overlooked Granderson did in the leadoff spot last year was bat .302, steal 26 bases, and hit 38 doubles, 23 triples, and 23 home runs. Tigers general manager Dave Dombrowski has been here before. His Montreal Expos were headed to the best record in their history before baseball's labor dispute derailed them in 1994. and his Florida Marlins won the World Series in 1997 when they were just 5 years old. Dombrowski says he faced an entirely different challenge with the Tigers, who lost a near-historic 119 games in 2003.
Coming in here where we had so many losing seasons in a row, we were in a position where you really had to change some of the culture here, some of the thought process of the organization. In Florida, we were able to start that from the very beginning. In Montreal, we were in a position where they already had a strong organization. They were winning a great deal during that recent time period, had never quite won a world championship, but the real foundation for the organization was already in place.
So Dombrowski overhauled the Tigers' scouting, player development, and Latin American operations, brought in manager Jim Leland, who skippered the Marlins to their 1997 championship, and signed free agent catcher Pudge Rodriguez to a 4-year, $40 million contract. Players like Ordóñez and Sheffield soon followed. And in 2006, the team shattered a string of 12 consecutive losing seasons, with 95 wins en route to their first World Series appearance in more than two decades. Along the way, Dombrowski won admirers, including manager Leland.
The one thing that I've noticed about Dave Dombrowski is he's very confident in his own judgment. He's not afraid to pull the trigger on a deal. He's very good at listening to his people, gathering the information, and then making the decision. And he always makes a final decision, and I think that's a sign of a great boss.
Center fielder Curtis Granderson, who studied business in college, likes Dombrowski's strategic planning.
With my business background, I look at it as, hey, you got to set a business plan, and that's what Dombrowski and the Tigers did. And that business plan was a work in process. You know, when they signed Pudge at that point in time, the plan was, okay, in a few years from now, we're going to be in a position where we want to by doing this, that, and the other. He's been doing a great job of it.
And rival GM J.P. Ricciardi of the Toronto Blue Jays still marvels at how Dombrowski drew marquee players to the Motor City.
Well, I think Dave's personality allows him to attract certain free agents to come to Detroit. Let's face it, I mean, the club lost 100-something games 1 year, and then for Dave to be able to get guys to go to Detroit, it really says a lot about, you know, his ability to interact with not only the players but the agents and get them to say, hey, Detroit's a viable place for us to go and play.
The only question left is whether at some point this season the Tigers will be considered the team to beat.
There's no question that we have a quality lineup, but we still have to go out there and do it. So I hope you're asking me that same question at the end of 2008, and then I'll feel a lot better about that because that means we've gone out there and we've been able to accomplish what we want to accomplish.
It remains to be seen how superstar third baseman Miguel Cabrera and former 22-game winner Dontrell Willis, both acquired for prospects from the Marlins during the offseason, pan out. Cabrera hit a home run on opening day but has batted well under 200 since, and Willis walked 7 in his Tigers debut. Detroit's unexpected losing streak to start the season, including dropping its first 6 home games against AL Central foes Kansas City and Chicago, has raised eyebrows, as has its paltry 2 runs per game scoring average. But the Tigers' start may turn out to be more of an underdeveloped snapshot compared to Dombrowski's big picture. And based on his track record, there aren't many in baseball who are betting against him. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. The Olympics is just around the corner. This is not the time for emotions to run wild, said Terry Tan, Singapore's former table tennis deputy president. But how could emotions not run wild when the breakup of Singapore's golden couple of sports has dominated the front page of the Sunday Times? National badminton player Ronald Susilo says he's mulling legal action against his former fiancée, table tennis champion Li Jiawei. Miss Lee says she finds Mr. Susilo's timing just months before the Beijing Games to be suspect. What's his motive and why now? Miss Lee told the Straits Times. I'm a girl after all, and he knows these things will upset me. Singapore. I'm Karen Given, filling in for Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a conversation with Barbara Smit, author of Sneaker Wars, the brothers who founded Adidas and Puma, and the family feud that forever changed the business of sport. But first, on Wednesday morning, thousands of people began lining up along the Embarcadero in San Francisco, hoping to catch a glimpse of the Olympic torch on its only stop in North America. Many more came out to protest for or against China's policies regarding Tibet, Darfur, human rights, and even cruelty to animals. Wyatt Buchanan, staff writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, walked the crowd and saw it all.
You know, it was a little unclear what might have happened. The police at one point asked people to disperse, and the crowd shouted back no really loudly and started chanting. But that was just one part of the route. As you went along, the crowds were thick with regular people wanting to see the torch.
Earlier in the week, the torch was marched through London with military efficiency as a group of 30 Chinese torch guards barked orders at frightened runners. It was under assault in Paris, where protesters tried to pour water on it and put it out. San Francisco's Mayor Gavin Newsom knew from these incidents that the torch relay was likely to cause controversy, but he said Wednesday that he hoped it would still go on.
Make no mistake, this is a very organic and dynamic process, not a static one, and we want to accommodate everybody.
Eventually, a disappointed crowd at the site of the scheduled closing ceremony was told that the torch would not make an appearance after being spirited on a shortened journey through another part of town with the most determined protesters and members of the media scurrying after it. Although some San Franciscans had lucked into excellent views of the torch passing beneath their windows, most who had lined up early in the morning to see it didn't even catch a glimpse. All were disappointed, including Wyatt Buchanan.
Yeah, I was. You know, I've been writing about this for about a month, and I don't get to express opinions about it, but I would have loved to have seen the torch. It's the Olympics. What can you say?
Joining me now to discuss what effect torch relay protests might have on Chinese policy and the 2008 Beijing Games is Joseph Fewsmith, director of East Asian Studies and professor of international relations and political science at Boston University. Professor Fewsmith, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much, Karen.
On Monday, the Beijing Organizing Committee characterized the torch relay as very successful and as having received a warm welcome in Kazakhstan, Turkey, Russia, and England. What, if anything, does the committee stand to gain by sticking to this assessment, even as the protests appear to increase in size and intensity?
Well, I think you're going to find that the Beijing authorities are going to assert that this is a successful run relay and a successful Olympics when that happens. They're very, very aware of what is going on. I don't think that they're going to acknowledge it in their official assessments.
The BOC also characterized protesters as a small number of pro-Tibet independence activists who have aroused resentment and received condemnation in London. Is it a small group we're talking about here?
Well, there have been a sizable number of people, as you're well aware, in London, Paris, and in San Francisco, which did not get to see the torch relay or to carry out their protest. So it's certainly a larger number than they're talking about, but it's been both of Tibetans and those who are sympathetic with them. But it's, as we'll get into, I think it's a very mixed bag about whether they're successful in some sense.
To what extent are people actually in China aware of what's going on?
Oh, I think they're very aware. They're not very happy at all with it. One of the side effects of this is that it's provoking a tremendous nationalist backlog within China. I can't emphasize enough how different the perceptions in China and outside of China are. This is a tremendous gap.
Well, explain to me how they're different.
Of course, in this country and around the world, a lot of people are extremely sympathetic to the Tibetans, and not without reason. Inside China, they are absolutely convinced, first, that Tibet is part of China. They believe, not altogether correctly, but not altogether without some truth, that the Tibetans have been treated well in terms of economic assistance and so forth. And, of course, Chinese are extremely proud of hosting the games, and they are understandably embarrassed and angry when somebody spoils the show.
Those watching the flame make its way through London couldn't help but notice a squad of 30 Olympic flame guards. It turns out that these men are Chinese paramilitary police, nicely disguised in blue tracksuits, who have been accused of manhandling protesters and barking orders at torchbearers. Certainly, Chinese officials must be aware that this does not reflect on the country positively.
This is one of those things. There are certain elements of the Chinese system, including the police, paramilitary, military, these are not easily changed. Their PR liaison people are perhaps not as sharp as the Chinese government would like them to be.
China has certainly expressed an interest in projecting a more reasonable, peaceful, and especially modern image through the Olympic Games. But recent crackdowns in Tibet show that it's still a regime that responds with force when it feels threatened. Can China change its image without changing the way it responds to conflict?
It's going to be difficult. There are certain issues that are quite fundamental and central to the Chinese system, and activities like in Tibet are one of them. It appears that the initial violence was actually carried out by the Tibetans, and that's been relatively little covered in the Western media, which is one of the reasons why the reaction in China is so different than outside of China. But certainly there has been a very large police presence in Lhasa and other Tibetan areas. That's going to continue, and the response is going to be heavy-handed. And I think it's probably going to be even heavier-handed because of what we're seeing along the torch relay.
Politicians have suggested sanctions, from an outright boycott of the games to some sort of limit on the number of dignitaries who attend. The most interesting response, I think, is French Foreign Minister Bernard Kouchner, who suggested a mini boycott and then said the next day, quote, "When you're dealing in international relations with countries as important as China, obviously when you make economic decisions, it's sometimes at the expense of human rights," end quote. To what extent is every decision related to China today an economic decision?
Well, China is a major economic player in the world today. And so, yes, I think governments around the world, corporations around the world are concerned about those. We wouldn't be waging a war in Iraq without Chinese money. That's political. It's also economic.
Will political pressure in the form of protests, international boycotts, and a perhaps slightly more well-informed citizenry do anything to change the situation?
No, in a word.
So what outcome do you see happening over the next few months?
Well, unfortunately, I really don't see a very good end to this. Before this all started, the Dalai Lama, on I believe it was March 6th, had a statement where he urged the international Tibetan community to be careful. And I think in issuing that statement, he was very well aware that the Tibetan community in Tibet and in China would pay the price for less than cautious behavior on the outside. And I'm afraid that premonition is going to come true, that at least in the short run, you're going to see a heavier-handed approach, not a lighter approach.
Professor Joseph Pugh Smith is Director of East Asian Studies and Professor of International Relations and Political Science at Boston University. Professor Pugh Smith, thanks for speaking with me.
Thank you very much.
At the 1936 Berlin Olympic Games, a young shoemaker named Adolf Dassler fitted a promising American athlete named Jesse Owens with a pair of cleats, and then watched with pride as Owens won 4 Olympic gold medals. For Audie and his brother Rudolph, Owens' performance was a huge boon for their small athletic shoe company. But just 12 years later, Audie and Rudy Dassler would split, setting up new ventures, Adidas and Puma. Over time, the bitterness between the brothers would change the way sports and business intertwined. Barbara Smith chronicled the history of Adidas and Puma in her new book, Sneaker Wars. She joins me from the BBC studios in Sheffield, England. Barbara, welcome to Only a Game.
Hello.
At the heart of this book is the feud between Adi and Rudolf Dassler. To call it sibling rivalry would be charitable. At the end of World War II, each brother seemed intent on getting the other jailed or worse. How is it that their relationship had become so strained that each would put his brother's life at risk to gain control of the company?
You know, there are many reasons, but one of the explanations is the animosity that there was between Rudolf Dassler and his sister-in-law, Käthe Dassler. He became absolutely obsessed and convinced that she was trying to gain control of the company. She was just 16 when she got married to his brother, and still she was really trying to exert influence, and he became very angry about this and tried by all means to retain control. And this took a paranoid turn, really, during the war. Of course, the stakes became quite different. And he became convinced that she somehow plotted to have him sent away to the front in the eastern parts of Germany.
Now, employees and family members were allowed to choose sides. The technical staff stayed with Adi to form Adidas, and almost the entire sales and administrative staff followed Rudy to the other side of the river to found Puma. Who had the advantage?
Well, I would say Adi really had the advantage in the early days because he had all the expertise. He was really the shoemaker. His brother Rudy was, you know, more outspoken, abrasive type of guy who was an excellent salesman. But at the beginning, he had very little to sell. And in later years, the fact that Adi was really the craftsman was an advantage. He came up with hundreds of technical inventions. I mean, you know, the sneakers that you see today, you know, you could point to tens of features that he invented. So he was definitely at an advantage in the early years, and certainly in soccer, which was and still is the dominant sport in Europe, he came forward with groundbreaking shoes.
Well, as you say, brothers Adi and Rudolf spent their entire lives in suspicion of and in competition with each other. Both brothers eventually split from their own sons. Adi's son, Horst, was basically exiled to France, where he set up a new Adidas factory and worked at times against the interests of his own parents. What kind of family was this?
Oh, it's a crazy family. I mean, the deeper you dig, the more layers you find. I mean, not only were the brothers fighting, but they also, you know, on each side had rifts with their children. Among the children, things weren't going well either. You know, it's what you'd call today a dysfunctional family, I think. So Horst was exiled to France. And on the other side, the elder son of Rudi Dassler, called Armin, was sort of exiled to Austria. And they started setting up companies that were essentially, you know, competitors to their parents' companies. So Horst Dassler in France set up Adidas France, but in the end he was much more marketing savvy than his parents, and so Adidas France actually led the international expansion of Adidas. And so in fact, when you go around Europe, a lot of people think that Adidas is French.
Well, Horst used his position in charge of the French branch of Adidas, as we call it here, to vastly expand and diversify the brand, sometimes secretly acquiring holdings in swimwear, sports equipment, clothing lines, and even sports marketing businesses. Adi was always against the idea of Adidas selling anything other than shoes. But without Horst's diversifications, would Adidas have become the brand it is today?
Yes, because in fact, the reason why Horst invested in all these other activities was that he was always afraid that, you know, these problems that he had with his parents would one day really trigger a complete breakup and that he would be completely evicted from Adidas. So he built up a sort of underground empire. And his parents knew nothing about this. I mean, this was, you know, a treachery on quite a staggering proportions. He acquired a part of Pony. He set up Arena, a swimwear brand. He acquired, in a very roundabout way, a company called Le Coq Sportif in France. And so he had this conglomerate of other brands that really had nothing to do with Adidas. It was, in fact, more of a burden than anything else once the family was reunited, or, you know, Horst took over the helm and all those brands were placed under the same roof.
My guest is Barbara Smit, author of Sneaker Wars. You're listening to Only a Game. Adidas and Puma were so intent on competition with each other that they failed to notice an upstart company in Eugene, Oregon. How damaging was that error?
Oh, that almost killed them. I mean, there was a fantastic example of business arrogance. Adidas for such a long time was such a dominant force. I mean, they were so much bigger than Puma after a while that, you know, they just didn't really take anybody else seriously. And particularly these Nike people, you know, they thought, what are they doing? You know, they're making so-called running shoes for people who are jogging. That's not even a sport. Look at these shoes. They're so soft. You know, it's not serious. And of course, millions of Americans started jogging and they decided to use Nike not only for jogging, but also actually for, you know, doing their groceries. And so Adidas was completely lost for several years in the United States. It's never recovered really from that blow. And of course, in the meantime, Nike progressed all around the world and has become by far the number one brand.
In the late 80s, the Dassler families lost control of Pumas and Adidas. Both companies were on the brink of collapse, and it took the combined efforts of banks and governmental agencies to keep them afloat. Do the Dasslers have any stake in either company at this point?
No, they don't. In fact, there's only one Dassler heir who still works at one of the companies. It's the grandson of Rudy Dassler, who's called Frank Dassler. And ironically, he's actually employed at Adidas. So that caused a bit of a furore in the small town of Herzogenaurach, where these things are still, you know, very sensitive.
Recently, both Puma and Adidas have made gains in market share, and Adidas is a major player in the industry, especially after its merger with Reebok. Would Adi and Rudy Dassler be proud of the traditions they started?
Well, I'm not sure about that. I think it's a completely different world. You know, when they started in their mother's laundry room at the back of their house. And Adidas, you know, his only interest was really tinkering with shoes. You know, Rudy Dassler was a little bit different. But certainly the world that we live in today would have been completely anathema to Adi Dassler. You know, they just wouldn't understand what's going on today. People like David Beckham earning several million a year just to wear three stripes on his feet.
Barbara Schmidt wrote Sneaker Wars, the brothers who founded Adidas and Puma, and the family feud that forever changed the business of sport, published by HarperCollins. She joined me from BBC Sheffield. Barbara, thanks for speaking with me.
You're welcome.
We're just a pair of old sneakers.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Charles River Apparel, introducing Charles River Sport, a new line of wicking polos and tees in a variety of team colors, charlesriverapparel.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The sight of Viking ships approaching England's bonny shores terrified many thousands of 8th century Englanders. But 21st century American stuntman Robert McDonald is taking a different tack. After gathering 15 million recycled ice cream sticks, McDonald, his son, and over 5,000 children constructed a 50-foot-long Viking ship, which departed from Holland on Tuesday. Instead of spears, swords, bows, and axes, McDonald and crew loaded up the Thor with cuddly toys to be delivered to children in London hospitals. Perhaps Eric Bloodaxe, Ingvar the Far-Traveled, Swain Forkbear, and Ivar the Boneless looked down on the scene from Valhalla and wished they'd have done things a little differently. I'm Karen Given, filling in for Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, sports tourism in Lower Manhattan. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me from Ithaca, New York, with the week's sports news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
Well, it doesn't happen all the time, so I have to say, when you're right, you're right. Just as you predicted, Kansas
I was
beat
really
Memphis
right
for the NCAA title.
I was
title.
Really right.
Were you sweating through overtime, though, because it was close?
No. I was sweating at the 9-minute and 12-second mark. in the second half. But once they got to the overtime, I realized that Memphis was so shell-shocked and out of gas at that point that it was only a matter of how many points Kansas was going to win by. And at the purely basketball standpoint, once Joey Dorsey fouled out of the game, they had no inside presence, and Kansas was just much too good for them in the overtime.
Do you think Memphis coach John Calipari will add new free throw drills to practices before next season?
I have a feeling we're not going to hear very much about how it doesn't matter the way we did in the run-up to the tournament. It's a lot easier to hit free throws when you're 30 points ahead than with the national championship on the line. I think we all discovered that.
Last week, you also told Bill that you thought Tennessee would beat Stanford, not Connecticut, for the women's championship. Were you watching your second great triumph on Tuesday?
I didn't see the championship game, but I did see Stanford and Connecticut. And I for reasons surpassing understanding, seen Stanford's women's team play twice this year, which is the only reason I made that call. You know, the legend of Pat Summert gets longer and more interesting by the day. And she really had a much better team than Stanford did. But Stanford's win over Connecticut was really a terrific effort by them.
Denver beat Golden State on Thursday night, effectively ending the Warriors' playoff bid. Too bad for Warriors coach Don Nelson, who now has to endure a hellish offseason in Hawaii. But good for the Nuggets, which is the more entertaining team to watch in the playoffs, right?
I think so. I think anytime you have Allen Iverson in the playoff context, it's a terrific game. I mean, he's one of the few players in the league who can shoot a team into the game all by himself. And I think he's demonstrated that he is a better teammate than he's given credit for, which he does over and over again by helping to get Denver where they are.
In the Eastern Conference, the Atlanta Hawks are battling for the eighth spot. That's fun because if the team does make the playoffs, it will have done so with a sub-500 record.
Well, that's your Eastern Conference for you, and that's what's going to send the people who really care about the Golden State Warriors up the wall. But since there's only about 15 of them outside of San Francisco, I don't think they have to be too concerned.
Seattle officials said this week that they have emails which prove Supersonic owners never intended to keep the team in Seattle. Despite negotiating for a $500 million public financing deal. That's it. My faith in humanity is completely shot. How about
yours? The horror. The owners of the Supersonics were lying all along. Oh, my goodness, the humanity. You know what? It's good to know because hopefully it will prevent the officials from other cities from giving in to goons like this, but it will matter not a darn, and that team will be in Oklahoma City.
O.J. Mayo announced this week that he will declare for the 2008 NBA draft. Mayo never made any secret of the fact that he'd only play for USC for a year. But did USC get a good return on their $35,000 tuition and room and board investment?
Well, let's assume that that's the investment because we don't like to throw out unfounded allegations. So let's assume that the investment was a mere $35,000. Yeah, I think so. They got to run into the tournament. They got a good show out of the guy. Both sides were quite clear about what the terms of the transaction was. I don't have a problem. I do have a problem with O.J. Mayo going into the NBA this year, though, because I think he's going to turn out to be a very loud bust.
On Wednesday, a 145-page report commissioned by the House Judiciary Committee blasted the NFL and its union over medical care for current and retired players. The committee had problems with the Players Association's reluctance to address the issue of concussions and permanent brain damage. Will this report lead to any changes in the NFL?
Well, I mean, there's already an uprising against Gene Upshaw among some of the players led by a kicker named Matt Stover. Most people don't care whether or not a sports league and a sports union are in cahoots. We had the NHL, in which Allen Eagleson represented labor and management for an awfully long time before anyone caught him. This is a really bad one. This one should embarrass Gene Upshaw, because the NFL Players Association has not acted within good faith to a lot of people who put their bodies at risk and whose bodies were destroyed by the playing of the game. And the NFLPA was supposed to look out for them, and it didn't. And this report is just another nail in the coffin. Gene Upshaw should slink away in shame.
While much of the world was watching protests that disrupted Olympic torch relays around the globe this week, Charlie, China announced that it had foiled a plot to sabotage the Beijing Games with suicide bombings and kidnappings. Well, now that that's settled, can we expect the rest of the torch relay to continue in peace?
Yes, because I have always found the Chinese government to be enormously credible on stories that might tend to lessen the embarrassment of what a human rights disaster they really are. So yes, I have no doubt that this story is absolutely the truth.
Charlie, in his second year as the honorary starter at the Masters and celebrating the 50th anniversary of his first Masters win, Arnold Palmer hit a drive that easily went out of sight. Wow, I didn't know he still had it in him.
Yeah, he hit it into the fog and nobody found the ball. So he's justified in saying he hit it 900 feet. And because he's Arnie, people should believe him.
Responding to former driver Aaron Fike's admission that he was on heroin while he competed in the Craftsman Truck Series, Sprint Cup drivers Kevin Harvick, Tony Stewart, Jimmy Johnson, and Casey Kane say they've never been drug tested at a NASCAR competition. Is it time for another congressional hearing?
Oh, God, I hope not. But I'll tell you one thing. The only proper response to the notion that a guy is driving trucks at high speed while on heroin is, holy God, this was something that came out of nowhere. But I'm very sure that look, they have drug testing. Look, they have steroid testing in golf now. Okay, so I suspect drug testing in NASCAR is not far behind.
Finally, Charlie, two Pensacon High School students were arrested earlier this week after a teacher found what might have been a hit list targeting actor Chuck Norris. The students say the list was a joke, but authorities are taking it seriously. Did these kids not know that Chuck Norris doesn't sleep, he waits?
Not only that, these two kids are now going to be known around the Norris household as hors d'oeuvres.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins Bill or me each week at this time on Only a Game. And he doesn't sleep. He writes. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
In the eyes of a ranger, the unsuspecting stranger had better know the truth of wrong from right.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can also leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website, onlyagame.org.
Because that's where the Rangers gonna be.
Over the past 7.5 years, visitors to the PATH train station on the edge of Ground Zero in Lower Manhattan have often been greeted by a street musician playing Amazing Grace. More recently, they've witnessed progress as the Freedom Tower, the soaring structure that will replace the World Trade Center, has begun to take shape. But Avi Schick, chairman of the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation, says downtown isn't just being restored, it's being rediscovered.
Lower Manhattan is being transformed from the world's leading commercial and finance district really to a world-class neighborhood and community. Certainly a big component of that is rebuilding commercial towers, but just as important are the other amenities that are necessary for a neighborhood, whether it's parks, whether it's transportation, upgrades, schools, and museums.
Since 9/11, Schick says, more than a dozen new museums have been slated for Lower Manhattan. One of the largest opens next month. The Sports Museum of America will be an interactive salute to all sports and the new home of the Heisman Trophy. Its location, directly between the Statue of Liberty Ferry and the World Trade Center Memorial, allows the museum to take advantage of Liberty Bonds, low-cost, tax-exempt financing meant to revitalize downtown New York. While the bulk of the $8 billion federally funded program has been awarded to projects at Ground Zero, Avi Schick says it's appropriate for more than $50 million to be spent on a for-profit museum dedicated to sports.
I think what the government was trying to do with the Liberty Bond program is to say to those developers or institutions that were willing to make big bets on Lower Manhattan in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, we're there with you, we'll be your partners. And this is a part of that, and so I think it makes, you know, all sorts of sense.
No one has made a bigger bet on the Sports Museum of America than its founder, Phil Schwalb. Liberty Bonds fund the bulk of the project now, but to get the idea off the ground, Schwalb needed seed money. Instead of securing a traditional loan, he decided to take cash advances on the combined $150,000 limit on his credit cards.
And then I realized that when I'd withdrawn like $30,000 in a day, that the other banks with whom I had credit might get jittery and reduce my lines of credit. So I decided I'd better get all the money out in one day. So actually that afternoon, within about a four-hour period, I went to Citibank and Chase and took it all out. So at the end of the day, we had $150,000. And that was quite an afternoon. And I was feeling quite wealthy by the end of the day. That didn't last very long.
Schwab's gamble worked, and after securing Liberty bonds and raising more than $40 million in private financing, his credit cards have long been paid off. But that doesn't stop friends from making jokes that the museum should be called the Sports Museum of America, brought to you by American Express, Citicorp, MasterCard, and Visa. It's mid-October, and construction is underway on the Sports Museum's exhibit halls and meeting space. Surrounded by concrete dust, exposed framework, and heavy plastic tarps, Schwab and Sam Gordon, manager of venue design, have no problem envisioning what this space will become.
So you come up these elevators, which don't exist currently, and when you get out, the first thing you see is Dream Big. So it's the sort of picture of Lance Armstrong on his bike when he was 10.
Tony Hawk in his garage with his father building a little jump.
Pele when he was 7 or 8. They're really sweet photos and sweet movies, and then the idea is to imbue children that are visiting with this sense, like, wow, there's Serena when she was 8 practicing. You know, maybe I can do that.
The Dream Big exhibit and the rest of the SMA's wall space will be populated with artifacts on loan from sports halls of fame. Some, like the Heisman Trophy and the Billie Jean King International Women's Sports Center, will relocate here permanently. Others, like the journal Jesse Owens kept during the 1936 Olympics in Berlin, will be on loan. But Schwab can't expect sports halls of fame to send him their best artifacts, can he?
Wrong. They will, for a couple of reasons. First of all, it bears well on them. But the other thing is they have just voluminous collections. The Basketball of Fame has, I don't know, I would say a couple of thousand artifacts on display and probably 20 or 25,000 artifacts in storage, and they rotate them.
Schwab says his team has worked hard to make sure the artifacts displayed in the museum are more unusual than just another ball or just another jersey. But co-founder Samir Ahuja says the real draw is the interactive nature of the museum.
It's impossible to put yourself, if you're not an athlete, which is the majority of the population, in that mode and in that mindset, what it's really like to be, you know, the person, you know, throwing a football in front of 100,000 people. And I believe that our venue will be the only place, like, in the world where you can kind of get to that last frontier where you're really put in the body and mind of the athlete. That's the thing I would go every day and do, because it would be something I wouldn't be able to experience anywhere else.
Hey, Derek. Who's Jackie Robinson?
Last week, some of those interactives were ready for testing in offices above a sandwich shop in Soho. Operand is the interactives company that's been working on the SMA's exhibits for 7 years, since before Schwab had secured financing for the project. In all, Operand is designing and building more than 20 pieces for the museum, everything from a Family Feud-style sports trivia game to a unit where fans can get under the hood of an NFL instant replay display, see what the referees see, and then find out how their opinion stacks up against the actual call.
Yeah, baby, all right.
Josiah Hobson, a principal at Operand, says it hasn't been easy putting together everything the museum wanted.
We have these hockey masks, and we wanted to give the feeling of what it's like to be a goalie. And you stick your face in the mask, and you see different shots on goal coming at you, and we couldn't find the footage anywhere. So we had to actually do an original photo shoot. We got the Rangers in their practice stadium to agree to let us come in and film them, and we brought a film crew in, and we shot original footage of the Rangers.
Hobson says the project was declared a resounding success when one of the volunteer testers found herself nauseated after watching a few virtual flying pucks coming at her head. This, despite the fact that the unit is currently just a hockey mask, fitted with a computer monitor, supported by FedEx boxes, and lots of packing tape.
We have a lot of stuff that's, you know, made out of cardboard, made out of tape, glue, plastic, whatever we can find to kind of, you know, fake what the real enclosure is going to be. Because really, like, typically we don't get to get our hands on the actual fully fabricated enclosures and all the hardware until a couple weeks before it opens. So we have to have everything done by then.
Hobson is confident that all the exhibits will be installed and working well in plenty of time for the museum's opening. But the Sports Museum of America still holds risks. Will the public come to Lower Manhattan in the numbers the SMA's thorough studies have predicted? Will other halls of fame continue to regard the museum as a useful partner instead of a threat? Phil Schwalb isn't afraid to take those risks. That's the lesson he learned on 9/11.
And I think that the occurrence for a New Yorker and for me as someone who was working and standing, you know, 25 blocks away watching what happened, the impact for me was, if you really believe in something, you know, you just need to do it.
The Sports Museum of America will open its doors at noon on Wednesday, May 7th. Only a Game is produced by Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Phil DiMartino and BBC Sheffield. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our Sports Museum of America photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from Sneaker Wars author Barbara Schmidt, who marvels over the mispronunciation of Adidas.
The logical pronunciation is Adidas. As much as the Adidas people in the U.S. try to correct whoever comes in their way, it won't change.
Well, that might be the logical pronunciation of Adidas, but it's also the wrong one. I'm Karen Given. Thanks for listening. Bill Littlefield returns next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Details are at gatesfoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.